In 1777, Captain Thomas Dooley was leading his regiment of the Continental Army near the Oconee River when they got involved with a group of Native Americans. As historian Hugh McCall tells it in his 1784 book, The History of Georgia, Dooley and his men were taken by complete surprise at about 7 a.m. on the morning of July 22nd. In the middle of the skirmish, Dooley took a shot just above his ankle that McCall says left him with a shattered leg and no way to move. Dooley's men, one might think, would rally around their wounded leader and valiantly fight to save their regiment. That, it appeared, would not be the case. Because Dooley's second-in-command, Lieutenant Cunningham, according to McCall's account, was one of the first to retreat, and the rest of the group soon followed, leaving Dooley alone to die. McCall wrote in his account that, quote, "The last man that saw him said that he was endeavoring to defend himself with the butt end of his gun, though he was unable to stand." In the wake of Dooley's death, his second-in-command was arrested and tried for cowardice, although he was reportedly acquitted. But the rage of Dooley's death would fall on the shoulders of his brother, Colonel John Dooley, a man that would seek vengeance for his brother's death not on the men who left him to die, but the Native Americans who the soldiers had come in contact with in the first place. And the John Dooley story, one of largely doing things his way, on his terms, across the Georgia frontier, in many ways begins there. And it would end 3 short years later, when he's murdered in his own home. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked, the podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And the marker we're talking about on today's episode sits just outside Lincolnton, Georgia, and marks what's known as the Tory Pond, the place where, according to the history books, a group of Tories were hanged following their murder of Georgia Colonel John Dooley. And like so many of these markers, it's not just about that location, but the story that comes through when you zoom out a little bit and look at it in a wider context. And we're doing that today, and to help me with that zooming out, we've got two men who might just be the best in the state at doing that. The first has been teaching American history in some capacity for 30 years at both high school and college levels. He is the author of From Empire to Revolution, Sir James Wright and the Price of Loyalty in Georgia. He is a graduate of Georgia State University and is currently at work on a second book about the Revolutionary Era. Dr. Greg Brooking, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Of course. Also joining us, he is a former professor of history at Wallace State College in Alabama. He is a renowned researcher in the field of history, genealogy, particularly in the American South. He's written hundreds of articles on the Civil War and the Revolution and advises the Georgia Trust for Historic Preservation on their efforts in preserving Georgia's revolutionary history. Among hundreds of articles and journals and other things written, Professor Bob Davis, hello.
Hi.
So I want to start with, when we talk about Georgia in the Revolution, obviously there's a lot of conversation around Savannah, right? It makes a lot of sense because that's where so much was going on. But there was also a lot that was going on outside Savannah, further up north, sort of in the woods, in the frontier, as it were. And I guess I'll start with you, Greg. Can you give us a sense of Georgia as a colony at the time in the Revolutionary Era, in the frontier, and what sort of what are we dealing with here?
Well, about the 1770s, we are dealing with a great deal of immigration to Georgia, to the frontier, to the Augusta region, as after Governor James Wright opened up additional lands to be settled, hopefully, he said, by small families rather than large plantation owners, small families because they could help defend the frontier. Now, he didn't actually necessarily stay true to that when it came to his own land dealings, but that's what we're dealing with. And it's an influx of immigrants that are causing troubles in the backcountry with the Native Americans as the two cultures collide.
Bob, I'll turn to you with this. Obviously the Torrey Pond story and that marker particularly is, sort of the ending of the John Dooley story. But I want to start at the beginning to some extent of, if we're going to tell the story of Torrey Pond and John Dooley, where does the John Dooley story begin?
All right. The murder of Colonel John Dooley is one of the greatest whodunits in Georgia history. He was probably born in Ireland. His family settled in Philadelphia. Then later they settled in the Valley of Virginia. Then at 96 in South Carolina. John Dooley becomes a very ambitious man who wants to achieve all the things his father never did. He acquires thousands of acres of land. He becomes a merchant. He becomes a deputy surveyor. But in his rise to power, he gets into conflict with a lot of people, and some of it turns violent, and some of it turns to threats of life and death. Now, just before the American Revolution, Dooley and his family are among some 800 families that move to Georgia to an area called the Ceded Lands. This is today Wilkes and surrounding counties. Now, this is a great moment for the settlement of the frontier because the British have cut off all free land on the frontier they've been giving before this time. And this land that is sold cheap, and you could borrow money from a man named Thomas Waters to make the first payments on your land. Okay, Dooley is into this thick and heavy.
When we talk about John Dooley, some of the research that I have read from historians like Otis Ashmore and Hugh McCall, right, the historians of the day, there's a great reverence for Colonel Dooley and sort of the way they describe him. And I'm curious if either one of you have an understanding of who he was in reality. And again, that's sort of, it's tough to answer, but versus, does that jive with the way that he sort of revered in some of the texts of the time? Do we know, is there any sort of discrepancy there? Does everything sort of flesh out that way?
No, it doesn't. And it never does. When you get down to find the real person behind the legend, the real person is somebody very different. It was said by James Jackson in Elijah Clark's obituary that you never had a finer friend or a deadlier enemy. And I think the same thing could have been said for John Dooley. He was somebody who was hugely ambitious. He didn't mind bending or breaking the rules. He didn't mind busting heads to fulfill his ambitions. And that's one reason he may have ended up being murdered. We do not know. But on the other hand, he was held in great reverence because everybody in Wilkes County lost someone during the American Revolution. The terrible story of what happened to Georgia during the Revolution has never really been told except in Hugh McCall's book. And it was much worse than even he portrayed it. Georgia was the only state that joined the American Revolution where every single part of the state was devastated by one side or the other during the war. And the entire state was a frontier. You talk about the upcountry, but there was nowhere in Georgia that was 50 miles from Indian country. And the British made every effort to make the Indians their allies. So Georgia was completely wrecked, and it was the only state to be reduced to colony status in the history of the United States. But we stayed with the Patriot cause, and we, obviously we're still part of the United States today.
I think Bob hit on something really important a minute ago, mentioning that the legends and are not who we perceive them to be. I mean, they're created to be legends for, you know, political purposes. I mean, these McCall and such, these are the first historians of the United States and of the Revolution, and they are writing with a real sincere purpose to create a nation, create unity. And I think that's a really important thing to understand about those first histories, is that they are really very much motivated by calls.
Well, what was it that made him so controversial?
Like I said, he's one of these people then and now who thinks the rules do not apply to them, at least as far as their ambition goes. He took over this settlement that he claimed he thought was abandoned. And having been abandoned, he was free to take it over. It was called Leesburg. And then the owner, Thomas Lee of Savannah, shows up and sues him. And throughout John Dooley's career from that moment on, the one thing everybody can agree on, loyalists, patriots, the reconstructed colonial government, the state government, everybody can agree that Leesburg does not belong to John Dooley. It belongs to Thomas Lee. And Dooley pulled every string he could to keep this property. But that was just typical of John Dooley. There are court cases in South Carolina that will leave you rolling on the floor laughing, where he threatens to kill people or people threaten to kill him. And, over debts and forgeries. And he sees an Indian peace delegation in revenge for what happened to his brother. And he was holding them hostage until he was persuaded by a friend to let them go. And that resulted in him having to give up his commission in the Georgia Continentals. And it resulted in his court martial.
You know, Greg, I'll point this one at you, is we've talked about this, but like a lot of the characters in the revolutionary period, it seems that there is a very fine line between ambition and, I guess for lack of a better term, recklessness. I mean, it doesn't take long before you're kind of like, wait, what are these guys doing? Am I wrong in that sort of assumption?
No, I don't think so at all. As you're asking the question, two names immediately, maybe three immediately pop to mind. One is, of course, Harry Lee, who was Robert E. Lee's father, who ran roughshod. And again, kind of like Dooley, didn't believe the rules much applied to him. The other is John Lawrence, Lieutenant Colonel John Lawrence, who was a favorite of George Washington, who died foolishly in a skirmish at the very, very end of the war. And then more locally, Mad Anthony Wayne. You don't get that nickname by being patient and calm and observing things before you act. So I think a lot of our founders, both political and military, kind of had that, sat on that fence a little bit, and sometimes you're on the one side, sometimes you're on the other. I think that colonists understood that there was a glass ceiling. As colonists, you can look at the papers, the founders from certainly from the North, from you know Virginia and northward, the Washingtons and such, and they all felt that they could only go so far. They aspired to be, you know, British gentlemen, and no matter what they bought and what they purchased, in British eyes, they were still just colonists. No matter how affluent they were here, they were just that. And I think that motivated a lot of folks to start something that they were at the top of, rather than they were second tier.
So it's ambition that helps explain who John Dooley became. But the event that truly defines the rest of his story and sort of shapes the entire thing comes much closer to home.
John Dooley was clearly a passionate person. You can see that in his letters. But and again, that was partly what got him into trouble, where maybe some tact would have been more appropriate. He was a captain in the Georgia Continental Horse. His brother was Thomas was a lieutenant. Thomas and a small group of Continentals were stationed on the frontier around Greene County, Georgia. Their horses were stolen by a party of Creek Indians. They set out after the Indians to get their horses back, not realizing they were marching into a trap. They were attacked in an they were ambushed. The men fought bravely, but they were driven off. They had to leave Thomas Dooley behind, who was shot in his Achilles heel. He was crying out to them not to abandon him, but they had to. There was, you know, it was either him or all of them. And this just absolutely outraged John Dooley. As to his character, when he was very controversial. The late historian Gordon B. Smith had no good words to say about him from the same records I used. And Gordon certainly was entitled to his opinion. But I like what Joseph Cartwright said. Someone asked him once, Joseph Cartwright, a Revolutionary War veteran, if he knew John Dooley. He said, "Knew John Dooley? Colonel Dooley saved my life." And that's the way I choose to think of it.
It appears to me from what I've read and what I've learned about him is that the death of his brother at the hands of the Native Americans, according to the texts, it seems like that was, and I guess I'll go to you, Bob, on this, if you can sort of explain sort of the, what we know about that instance and that event. But it seems like that event was sort of a driving force throughout his life.
His little brother, Thomas, was not just his little brother. He was more like his protege. The Dooleys lost their parents fairly early on. And John Dooley was the head of the household. He was the father figure. His four younger brothers were all more like his sons.
John Dooley, as I imagine any brother would, is near driven insane by this prospect of his brother dying at the hands of the Creek, and he wants to exact cold-blooded revenge. The leaders in Georgia at the time, both moderate and fairly radical, don't really want him to pursue that path because it is going to create a situation that they may not be able to handle just yet. And so they try to prevent him from doing that.
Later that year, Dooley manages to seize a group of Creek Indians. And before he can carry out his vengeance of Thomas's death, he's arrested. He's tried in Savannah, and the court-martial is led by another familiar name in colonial history, Samuel Elbert. And as a result of all of this, Dooley resigns his commission and becomes colonel of a militia in Wilkes County. And in 1779, John Dooley goes on to lead that militia at Kettle Creek, serving alongside Andrew Pickens and Elijah Clark. Kettle Creek was a really important battle in the Revolution and in the Southern Theater. And more importantly, it was a huge victory for the Patriots.
We've got to remember, this is a civil war. And the rules are, they're not what we would maybe like them to be in hindsight, you know, as we place our own contemporary judgments on people. It's a civil war, and they are brutal and they are ugly.
One of the characteristics of the fighting in frontier Georgia is that the fights are smaller. They're more personal. And for men like Dooley, they can become a never-ending cycle of revenge.
It is recrimination for recrimination. Each side is exacting revenge for past wrongdoings, and there's not always an ideological reason behind it. It's not patriotism versus loyalism. It's, you burnt my father's farm down, now I'm coming for you. And so Dooley finds himself as someone who's always acting the aggressor.
All right, we know for a fact that he was murdered in front of his wife and children. That's unquestioned. That's actually in the records when they were given land after the American Revolution, after they took Leesburg away from them and left them on the road with nothing. The state of Georgia gave them new land. But here is what I believe happened. And it's not a question of legend supplanting the truth. It's the fact that the truth has been hidden until the bicentennial 50 years ago. And what is probably the truth is out there now. Why it was why it is lost, I have no idea, because it's a tremendous story. I mean, they make movies out of stuff like this. All right, Elijah Clark comes back to Wilkes County with his guerrillas, and he tries to get together a force to attack the Tories at Augusta, the Tory garrison at Augusta, the British followers at Augusta, and turn the American Revolution in the South around. He gathers about 400 men, some of whom are only along on threats to their lives. They attack the Tory garrison at Augusta. They almost succeed, but Thomas Brown, the Tory commander, he and his men hold out in a stone Indian trading post by the river and issue all kinds of threats of the terrible things they're going to do to Elijah Clark and his following when they win. Then reinforcements arrive under a man named John Harris Krueger from 96. They save the Tory garrison. They drive out Clark and his followers. They hanged 13 of Clark's men that they captured and turned the rest over to the Indians to be put to death. Then Krueger and his men, with Wilkes Countyans who supported the revolution, burned down Wilkes County. We're talking about today's Wilkes and surrounding counties. They burned down more than 100 homes and forts. They burned down the courthouse at Washington, Georgia. We have a letter from Krueger written from John Dooley's home. He doesn't mention Dooley in the letter. He just says that's where he's at the moment. And what probably happened is that loyalists, either Conkle, Corker, or McConkle, or Winder, we've got four different versions of who the loyalist leader was, came to Dooley's fort, and they murdered him in front of his wife and family, presuming that he had something to do with Clark's attack, and not really caring whether he had any. And to be honest with you, if the tables were turned around and Dooley was doing this, Dooley probably wouldn't have cared either. They had been through a horrible experience, and now they were going to inflict a horrible experience on the people in Wilkes County. Now, Elijah Clark gathers all the Wilkes County refugees, about 700 people, black and white, men, women, and children, and they flee through the Indian country to reach modern-day Tennessee. They have no food. This takes 2 weeks. It's only what they can, find in the woods that sustains them. The one-third of the British Army in the South, the American Corps under Patrick Ferguson, set out to catch Clark and destroy him, which they think will bring about the end of the American Revolution in the South. That will crush all the resistance. However, Ferguson and his men move too close to Clark. They find themselves cut off from the British Army, and that's when another army made of North Carolina militia and South Carolina militia and some Virginians show up, surround Ferguson and his men at Kings Mountain, and destroy them. That's the beginning of the end for the British in the American War in the South. And you can think of it, Colonel John Dooley's murder was a part of the beginning of what ended the American Revolution in the South, which ended the American Revolution in America on that. So it's not, all of this has been left out of history. And even if you go to Kings Mountain today at the National Park Museum, they will not say one word about Elijah Clark and the Georgians who made it possible, or the battalion of Georgians who fought at Kings Mountain. Elijah Clark wasn't able to be with them, but men from his outfit. So that is what I believe happened. And until somebody like Krueger comes forward with a full confession, I'm afraid that's as close as I'm probably ever going to get.
This is an incredible chain of events. One murder on the Georgia frontier actually becomes connected to one of the turning points of the entire Southern campaign during the Revolution.
The legend is that John Dooley, in front of his wife and kids in his own home, was murdered by a band of Tories. According to Hugh McCall's First History of Georgia, a band of Tories under the clear direction of a man named Captain Corker break into John Dooley's log cabin home in the middle of the night.
He finds himself in harm's way in front of his family, and he is murdered. Because of the successful Patriot propaganda, they are able to paint him as a martyr at the time of the revolution.
John Dooley's death symbolizes what's going on in the rural frontier of Georgia. He's been killed, and while the specifics are still unclear, this is a murder. And that kind of rises to a different level, even in the context of war.
Patriot propagandists use John Dooley's death in front of his family, in front of his children. They use the very loaded term murder in a time in which we're killing people left and right, honorably and dishonorably, including Dooley himself killing folks dishonorably and his enemies killing others dishonorably. That's the nature of civil war.
And so, look, the historical record tells us that John Dooley was murdered, right? But what happens next is really where the story becomes a lot more difficult to parse out, to untangle.
Okay, we know next to nothing, but that's not going to make it any easier. Now, there's a separate set of legends involving a woman warrior named Nancy Hart. Hart County, Georgia is named in her honor. And in the 1820s,
our team is very familiar with Nancy Hart. She was one of the episodes we did. Yeah, we love that story.
All right, very good then.
Yeah.
Well, you know the story of her being abused by a loyalist who had just murdered Colonel Dooley, and they force her to serve them her favorite turkey or something. And she seizes them, and then she calls for Colonel George Dooley, John Dooley's brother, and the John Dooley's brother, George, and his men hang the Tories. And in later legend, they hang them at Tory Pond. And some bodies were recovered near there later on when they were building a road, but nobody knows, you know, for sure whose bodies they were, but they fit the story and they fit the legend on that. I should also add that John Dooley had a little boy named John Mitchell Dooley. And according to one very old account, John Mitchell Dooley actually executed the men who murdered his father. Now, he would have only been like 5 or 6 years old or something, but how old do you have to be to slap the back of a horse with a man with a noose around his neck? The big problem with that story is that all the people who are accused of being John Dooley's killer, the various Tory captains, all died somewhere else. Although one man, a captain, William McCorkle, was accused of this. After the revolution, he writes to the Georgia legislature and asks to be taken off the Banishment and Confiscation Act. The Georgia legislature votes to do that, but nobody ever tells McCorkle. So 20 years later, McCorkle is writing again to get this done. And by then they've pardoned everybody or almost everybody. So the legislature reads the bill twice and are already to allow McConkle to return, when who should stand up but a legislator named John Mitchell Dooley. And for whatever reason, the third vote was never held. And McConkle was never allowed to come back to Georgia.
Whether every detail of the Tory Pond story happened exactly that way it's never going to be known, right? But that raises a different question, which is, why has this version of the story endured for nearly 250 years?
Yeah, I'm pondering. I'm thinking about that last moment. And that's where I think, in a lot of ways, propaganda steps in. James Wright, certainly, and a Thomas Brown, Burt Foot Brown of the King's Rangers, loyalist, they would have had different opinions about the deserving, I think that's the word you used, Bob, whether he deserved that kind of a death. And we don't know exactly what kind of a death it was, but there were plenty at the time willing to talk about how uncivil it was. And propaganda was just so important. The patriots or the rebels, whatever you want to call them, they always had the upper hand. And we could take that back to 1765 with the Stamp Act, with the Boston Massacre and Paul Revere, you know, getting that that image out before the British could get the image out back in London and across the colonies of the massacre. Propaganda was such an important part of this war, and it helped shape the outcome of the war, probably more than a lot of people would be willing to admit or know.
The legend of and the story of John Dooley, I mean, you got to go looking for it, right? And thanks to people like Bob who research it and kind of keep it sort of in the universe, in the research world. But there is something about the John Dooley story that is interesting, and I can't put my finger on it. And I'm curious why the story of somebody like John Dooley and who he was matters in sort of this, in the larger picture of Revolutionary Georgia.
For me, he matters because he is so, I think, similar to so many other folks that, as Bob said, are on the make and are ambitious and see opportunity in the revolution and seize it. And there's something admirable about people who seize opportunities when it's just so easy to let them go by. And so I think that's probably the most important part for me of his story, is that he is just archetypical of so many. And I love complexity. And so he's a complex man, good and bad and otherwise. And so I love that aspect of it as well.
Okay. First off, we all love a whodunit. And then you set the whodunit in the American Revolution, and you've got Tories versus Patriots. And, you know, you've got a John Jakes novel in the making, although he never made this one, unfortunately. Also, and this haunts me, and it haunts everyone who's ever been in the military. You know, you think you're going to live forever. You think you're going to achieve great things. You think that you can't imagine your own death. You have to be in a military situation, in a war, in a conflict like that, and you realize that your life is not guaranteed. Your future is not guaranteed. You could die at any moment. It's not a question of some divine spirit decides these are good people, and their good people are always going to live, and the bad people are always going to die, and it's all going to have a nice Hollywood ending. I mean, anybody who ever sent sons or brothers or fathers off to war and they never came back, they know exactly what I'm talking about. Or even in our own time, a lot of people I know have known people you would have thought you were going to outlive, you thought were going to, people who walk out the door one day and never come back. And the real lesson in this is that when you create a conflict like the American Revolution, when they say you're putting, that our signers of the Declaration of Independence put their lives and their property and their liberty at risk, that isn't just a saying, it was real. People did die for their principles. They died because they picked the wrong side. They died because they chose the wrong person. It is a cold reminder of what none of us want to be reminded of, that none of us are guaranteed anything.
John Dooley's story reminds us that history rarely fits neatly into the categories of hero or villain. He was ambitious, controversial, admired by some, distrusted by others, and ultimately caught in one of the most violent chapters of Georgia's Revolution. The marker at Torrey Pond doesn't answer every question about his life or his death. Instead, it actually invites us to keep asking them. And maybe that's exactly what good history is supposed to do. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.